Hi, can you hear me properly? Yeah? Okay, thank you. All right, so I was informed about this lecture just 3-4 days ago. Somebody else, Dr. Sai Indamuri, was supposed to give this talk, but at the last minute turned out he could not give the talk, so I had to quickly prepare it and give it to you. So the good thing is the talk is very short, so only 30, 35 slides, so hopefully it will finish quickly. The bad thing is I didn't get enough time to really put it the way I wanted it to be. I've never attended any lecture in this particular course, but I've heard from people who have taken it maybe 4 or 5 years ago that the things that are covered in this particular course can actually get boring. I'm not sure, maybe too clinical or too many different things. So the same applies for lung cancer research. So I believe last week you had a talk by Dr. Wugu on clinical aspects of lung cancer, and I'm supposed to cover the research part of lung cancer. But research is a small word, but can mean many things. So I will be covering some aspects of lung cancer research just to give you an overview. I'll still be missing important parts of lung cancer research. For example, I'm not going to talk about biomarker research, basically looking at molecular markers, could be proteins, mRNAs, mutations, epigenetic changes like histone modifications, which can indicate presence of disease or how bad the disease is, etc. So I'm completely skipping that part. In fact, each of these aspects of lung cancer research can itself take an entire lecture. So again, Google, PubMed, all of my best friends, if you're interested, you can always find up-to-date and probably more correct information than what you will get on, the slide notes. But anyway, so just a quick question. When do you think the first case of lung cancer was identified? The first case of lung cancer, obviously in humans, was documented, somebody wrote about it. Just a guess. How long ago? In the 1600s? 1962 to close. But yeah, the first case was actually documented in 1751. And in fact, one survey, which was done in 1898, which looked at cases documented all over the world up to 1898, there were only 140 cases. All over the world, only 140 cases. Obviously, the population of the world was a tenth, maybe 20th of what it is today, but it was very low. There was a review in 1912, which identified 374 cases all over the world. And look at 2012, we had 1.8 million estimated cases of new lung cancers in 2012. So obviously everybody knows why this big change happened, cigarette smoking. But just out of curiosity, can anybody kind of suggest or explain why these numbers may be lower than what might have been? What may have made these numbers higher? So one thing with lung cancer is that it's an internal disease. You don't get a bump, you don't get pain until it's later stage cancer. So picking lung cancer, and back then you didn't have x-rays or CTs or accidental discovery of lung cancer during routine annual medical visits. So obviously these numbers are probably underrepresenting the true incidence of lung cancer. The other thing is, back then, people had shorter lives. So average longevity, again, depending on the geographical region of the world, was in the 40s, 30s, 50s. And most lung cancer, turns out, happens in late 40s, 50s, and 60s, so forth. So people were not getting lung cancer. They were dying because of other reasons. But still, there has been a big increase in lung cancer over time, all because of cigarette smoking. So it raises this question, is lung cancer a man-made disease? I was, you know, I was in a conversation with a stranger, and he was asking me what kind of research I do, and I was telling him about lung cancer research. And he said, it's such a waste of taxpayer money. All that the government has to do is ban smoking, and lung cancer is gone. And all this research and everything that you're doing, what's the value of it? Of course, I would tell him that there is non-smoking associated lung cancer, so not everything is smoking associated, but smoking is a big deal here. And so, yeah, I would say that it's largely a man-made disease. And maybe in 100 years, it will be, you know, the incidence, the prevalence rate of lung cancer will be very low, unlike what it is today, you know, the number one cancer. So smoking has been known for a long time. This is just an illustration of a Mayan god shown smoking. This is dated to 1st century BC. And of course, there are other, you can find on Google, there are other illustrations of Mayan god smoking. This is like a classical case of religious deities smoking. But people do question how correct this is. For example, can anyone say why this may not be actually a cigar or a cigarette? So some people question that this is actually not smoking. And one of the reasons is, a couple of reasons is that if you look at what's coming out of the end of this, it's supposed to be smoke, but then people question if it's smoke, why isn't it rising up? Why is it spreading out? So could it be, for example, a musical instrument instead of a cigar? The other thing is, if you look at the hands or the fingers of this person, they seem to be touching the lighted end of this thing. And so is it really, again, a cigar and all that? But anyway, the thing is, smoking has existed in society for a long time. But it was difficult to smoke because, you know, you had to grow tobacco or related plant species. You had to roll them by hand and all those things. So it was really not that prevalent. But obviously, as smoking increased over time, you see huge increases in lung cancer. So what facilitated this increase in smoking? I mean, people were not smoking, and all of a sudden, over the last 100, 150 years, there was a huge increase in smoking. But before then, when smoking was difficult, you know, it was more expensive or difficult to acquire, this habit was not common in society. And in fact, even the little amount of smoking which went on in society had been banned back in, for example, in China, in Germany. In fact, 100 years ago, almost a third of the country in the United States, smoking was banned in the States. But then, eventually, I guess, capitalism won, and somebody came up with an invention which could roll out cigarettes. This is a Bonsack cigarette roller, which was invented, again, like 150 years ago. This could churn out cigarettes. It drastically reduced the prices of cigarettes, which were otherwise luxurious items, and that increased, you know, consumption in the society. And we all know today, you know, all these tobacco, cigarette manufacturers, they make, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue, very high profit margins, and so forth. So all these things, public acceptance, this business or monetary interests, they all contributed to this rise in cigarette smoking. At some point, even today, it's believed that many countries, like, for example, in China, in early part of the century, was getting about a tenth or 10% of its tax revenue through cigarette sales. So same in this country. Also, the amount of taxes that cigarettes generate is very high. So again, it's very difficult for politicians to completely kill off cigarette smoking. And of course, there's the other issue that there has been public opposition until recently. But hopefully over time, all this will eventually happen, that the public acceptance of smoking, the legal facilitation of smoking practice, all that will eventually end. And it seems like it's already happening in the United States. This is data from the SEER database, which is a registry of cancer incidence and statistics, basically showing that it seems that over the past few years, the new cases of lung cancer that are detected, as well as the cancer-related mortality, both have been decreasing over time, and it sort of suggests that the reduction in smoking rates is responsible for that. But still, as I noted before, there are like about close to 2 million cases of lung cancer patients identified every year. And even though there is a decrease in disease burden occurring in the United States, you still have a lot of other regions in the world which is a huge, where the disease will remain a huge problem for many years. And so, for example, about half of all the lung cancer cases that occur in the world are occurring in places like China, India, and other developing countries. The burden in developed countries is, if you look at Europe and the United States, it's not as high. So this is just giving an idea about the disease in general and how it might be a man-made disease, etc. You know, so one of the questions is, if obviously, if you were to do a PhD thesis, or you have to decide on a research focus for your professional life, would you pick up lung cancer? For example, if you knew that in, let's say, 5 years, lung cancer will be eliminated, then probably a lot of people will not study lung cancer. But the thing is, 5 years, it won't be 5 years, probably 50 years, maybe 100 years. So it still remains an active area of research and worth pursuing. The other thing is that the findings or the things which are discovered and understood while studying lung cancer apply to other things. So lung cancer research has yielded many interesting observations, many methods of doing research, which are applicable to other fields of cancer and biomedical research. So for example, some of the epidemiological studies which have been done with lung cancer are classic designs which were developed by those investigators, and those designs are used for other diseases. Same thing applies for biology. Many of the molecular pathways, etc., which are identified through lung cancer research, they apply to other types of cancer as well as biology in general. But it is still true that there is an, you know, ephemeral value or nature to the knowledge which is obtained with research. Many of the things which were interesting not just because of their novelty, but also because of their application to other parts of science, lose value. And so, for example, you might be studying some drug X, and maybe in 5 years that drug is banned because of some toxic effect, or maybe there's a much better drug, so that drug X is never used. But you can imagine possibly hundreds, thousands of studies which may have been done regarding that X, the drug X, how it works, what's the pharmacology, you know, what's efficacy, what you can combine it with. So all that knowledge can suddenly become valueless, meaningless, and it's kind of a depressing thought. This is just something to, you know, think about philosophically. And same thing with applies to techniques also. So, you know, if you look at, for example, Nobel Prize winning discoveries in biomedical sciences, you'll find that probably half of or more of the work is related to techniques. Or if you look at the Lasker Award nominations, you know, PCR and radioimmunoassay and so forth. But so they are very exciting. They can generate a lot of money for companies. They obviously have huge value to other researchers, and that's why they win the prize. And often they are the most creative kind of science that goes on, so it's fun to do. But still, they can lose value over time. And just an example, you all know about next generation sequencing. Microarrays were, you know, invented basically in early 90s, and over a year, over the next 15, 25 years, the use of microarrays exploded. A lot of companies making lots of money with microarrays. A lot of people using for all kinds of studies. You know, many times studies were done just you know, let's see what happens. You have a technique to look at all gene expression with microarrays, let's just use it, and so forth. And this is just somebody had a paper where they talk about microarrays versus next generation sequencing. What has happened is that a new player has entered the market, next generation sequencing, which is not only more accurate and replicable and sensitive, it also lets you look at, besides gene expression, you can look at altered splicing of mRNAs, you can look at mutations or sequence variations in mRNAs. And so that has, and as the price for this new technology, the sequencing platform, has gone down, people are getting more inclined towards it. So over time, this use of microarray is already sort of coming to a plateau. This is data up to 2012. And the sequencing method is going to come up. And all the work that has been with microarray, if you look at bioinformatics research, if you look at just the technique-related, the engineering-related research, all of that is, in a way, going to go waste. Same applies for other things. This is just another example. You all know of the CRISPR-Cas method for genetic engineering to delete DNA, to mutate DNA, to even cause exogenous expression of genes, etc. This is like the hottest thing now. You have hundreds of papers coming out now every year using this method. And it's a really nice method, but but other methods to achieve the same kind of thing using techniques that used zinc finger nucleases or TALEN nucleases or mega nucleases, they were also hot at some point in time. But then as better techniques emerged, they have lost their value. So again, a lot of people who worked on this, some of these works were termed, discoveries of the year back, in their time and so forth. So so this was just a thought about, what's the timeliness or the long-lasting value of knowledge that we generate from research. Okay, so back to lung cancer research. As you know, there are many aspects of lung cancer research, and so there's the epidemiological aspect, there's aspect related to diagnosis or testing, there's related to, treatment of lung cancer, biology of lung cancer, many other things. We don't talk about like preventive approaches, historical approaches, legal questions, and so forth. In the lecture last week, you probably heard about a lot about the treatment, et cetera, and the type of lung cancers and how lung cancer is diagnosed, or what are the different techniques, radiology or pathologic grading, et cetera, and so forth. So here, I'm not going to cover talks about treatment or diagnosis from the clinical angle, but in general, most lung cancer is treated by surgery, and there are medical treatments available. For late-stage diseases, you combine surgery with a second or adjuvant kind of therapy. For early-stage cancer, you usually just do surgery. Regardless, the mortality rate for lung cancer is very high. In fact, it has barely changed over the last 2-3 decades. For early-stage lung cancer, people have are trying and experimentations using different things, EGFR inhibitors, etc. For late-stage lung cancer, your radiation therapy, etc., or chemotherapy, you can add on to surgery to improve survival. But in general, it's not very good. So, epidemiology, I don't know if you have like separate classes on epidemiological aspect in this course particularly, but just to briefly give you an idea, people started suspecting association of cancer, lung cancer, with smoking back in the 19th century, and it was really this study, the British doctor study, which was done in the second half. It was a long study, 50-year long study in the second half of the 20th century, which sort of confirmed or really demonstrated the association of lung cancer with smoking. This was a study done by two Okay. So where were we? Okay, so this was the study where they, at the time in the early 50s, late 40s, about 80% of British doctors used to smoke. So they, these people, these epidemiologists, Dahl and Hill, decided to follow them and see how many develop cancer, how many don't, etc. And so this was a classic study, and of course this study went on to examine other things, not just lung cancer, other things associated with smoking, etc. Then, I mean, this is slightly different, mesothelioma, you know about this. This is cancer of the pleural membranes or the coverings of the lung. And again, epidemiologically well associated with asbestos. About 80% of mesothelioma in the world are caused by asbestos exposure. In the United States, asbestos is obviously declining, but this disease usually comes up in the 60s and 70s, and one is in the 60s and 70s. So people have been exposed in the past are still developing this disease. So overall, you get to see maybe, I think, 3,000-4,000 cases of mesothelioma in the United States, but over time it will eventually drop off. The use of asbestos in the United States obviously has been largely banned. Its production was stopped in 2002. Then there are other interesting findings that which epidemiology provided. Some of these have biological relevance in some ways. So for example, there has been speculation that altitude or elevation of the geographical area where you live can actually affect development of cancer. So most of these are, again, you know, classic epidemiological studies where they look at cancer registries and how long somebody has lived in a particular area and other things. And so this is one of the studies where they again try to show that there is a good correlation between reduced incidence of lung cancer and higher elevation. So higher up you live in a place, let's say in Colorado or Denver area or somewhere, you have lower chance of getting lung cancer. And this actually applies to a few other types of cancer. It's not just lung cancer, but in this particular study, which was published in last year, they show that this thing, the association of reduced incidence of lung cancer with high altitude, you know, holds true regardless of smoking prevalence. So even smokers have a reduced risk of developing lung cancer if they live at a higher altitude, and they control for many things. So one can say, you know, for example, maybe ultraviolet light exposure or exposure to radioactive gases like radon is altered at higher altitude, and that's why that explains the association of altitude with lung cancer. So they've tried to control for these other confounders. And so, for example, this paper speculates that maybe oxygen actually drives development of lung cancer. So at higher altitude, you have reduced oxygen levels in blood or in the atmosphere, and that helps, you know, slow down the growth of lung cancer. Finally, regarding epidemiology, a new thing which will be focus of study, and this is already happening, are e-cigarettes or vaping. And as the use of cigarettes have fallen, the use of e-cigarettes have increased. And people have already studied, including at Roswell, have started examining the biological effects of vaping or use of e-cigarettes. So as you know, e-cigarettes, basically, they deliver nicotine. So you have pure nicotine which is delivered through the inhalation route. But to propel or to get that nicotine into a vaporized form, which can be inhaled, it is combined with other chemicals. And the real worry is about these other chemicals. It's not the nicotine itself. Although nicotine association with cancer in many different ways is known, but it's really the other compounds in these formulations of nicotine, which is what worries people. But one thing is for sure, they cannot be as dangerous as cigarette smoke. So it's good in a way, but there are many unknown things, which, and it will take many years as you know, epidemiologically analyzable data takes time, decades maybe, to, and you don't know what the long-term effects are, etc. But people have already shown that many of the constituents in the e-cigarettes, they can affect things at the cellular level in vitro cell culture model. You can see how they affect different types of cells of the pulmonary or the lung system. So immune cells, fibroblasts, the epithelial, respiratory epithelial cells, they all can be affected by the cigarette, e-cigarette constituents. They can change, you know, viability of cells, make them more susceptible to infection, et cetera, et cetera. But then there are critics of these kind of studies also, because a lot is not known, like what the doses of chemicals that are used in these studies, do they really reflect the concentrations of chemicals which a human gets exposed to if they were to vape? So this is again another part of aspect of epidemiological studies on lung cancer. So I'm going to shift a bit here and talk a little bit about what causes lung cancer. And so there have been a number of large projects, one of them, the famous one being the Cancer Genome Atlas Project, or the TCGA project, where close to maybe 10,000 human patient tumors representing maybe 15 to 20 different types of cancers have been analyzed for many different things. So you take the same tumor and sequence it for RNA, DNA, look at histone methylation, you can look at gene expression, you can look at mutations, altered splicing, changes in genome structure, etc. So two large studies have been done regarding lung cancer in this project, one of them with lung adenocarcinoma, the other with lung squamous cell carcinoma, which, you know, are the two common types of lung cancer, accounting for about 85% of all lung cancers. And so, as expected, some of the well-known oncogenes or tumor suppressor genes, which have been associated with other types of cancers, they are also found to be mutated in lung adenocarcinoma, classic examples being P53. So you see a very high occurrence. Like in this particular study, they found that 46% of the lung cancer samples had P53 mutations. But then there were other mutations, some of them, for example, BRAF, which have been associated with other types of cancer like skin cancer. And then there were mutations which were seen for the first time in lung cancer. So the nature of mutations across lung cancer, adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma, varies. So in some people, a particular set of mutations is seen, in some different set of mutations is seen, but overall a pattern is seen where you can find that few genes like EGFR, STK11, KRAS, P53, etc., get mutated much more frequently. Same kind of data has been obtained for squamous cell carcinoma. Again, you find P53 mutations occurring in about 81% of cases, but then you also see some mutations which are not seen here. For example, you don't see KRAS mutations occurring in squamous cell carcinoma. Same, you don't see EGFR mutations occurring in squamous cell carcinoma. So besides squamous cell and adenocarcinoma, you have other lung cancer types, you have small cell carcinomas, you have carcinoid cancers, neuroendocrine tumors, etc. So there are projects where people have tried to understand what's the mutational profile, again, to try to understand what might be driving these mutations, and based on the types of genes which get mutated, if you can devise targeted therapies to treat tumors based on the exact nature of mutations they have. So many of these mutations, or the genes which are mutated in lung cancer, have been known for a while. For example, KRAS mutations are well known, and people have used that information to generate mouse models of lung cancer. So in general, the signaling pathway, the major signaling pathway in lung cancer associated, in lung cancer, involves the EGFR pathway or the TGF-beta pathway. So mutations in genes and coding for protein mutations or engineering of genes along this pathway can and do give rise to different types of lung cancer in rodent models and mouse models, basically. So people have mutated or deleted EGFR or RAS, KRAS, etc., or LKB1 to generate these models. So we'll talk about these transgenic models a bit later, but besides these genetic models, there are also spontaneous or chemical-induced models of lung cancer in the mouse. So spontaneous models are basically just cancer developing on its own. It's believed that in the wild, mice have a prevalence rate of about 3% of lung cancer. So 3 out of 100 mice caught in the wild of certain age tend to have lung nodules, lung tumor nodules in them. But certain strains of mice, certain strains of laboratory mice, which are used for research, are highly susceptible for lung cancer development. So one of the strains is A/J, or the AJ strain. There's another strain, SWR, which is also susceptible. In particular, this AJ strain, all mice by the age of 16 to 24 months or so will develop lung cancer. And it is known why this happens. So people figured out that these mice have a polymorphism in their KRAS gene, which makes it more active and leads to the development of cancer. But the good thing with these spontaneous models like is that you can study aspects of biology or what affects development. So there are other things besides that particular oncogene which can lead to development of cancer or promote it. Things like diet, for example, or environmental factors like temperature. So these are very well, very frequently used in lung cancer studies. Then treatment-induced lung cancer. Once the association of cigarette smoking with lung cancer was established, people tried very hard to develop. So basically, they tried to make mouse and rats inhale cigarette smoke so they can develop cancer, but it turned out that they do not. So cigarette smoke by itself is very weak in inducing cancer in the mouse. On the other hand, if you were to take particular constituents or chemicals of cigarette smoke and use those pure chemicals, it's much easier to develop lung cancer in these mouse models. So for example, these are some ways in which people generate lung cancer in mice using different methods. In both mouse and rats. For example, NTCU is a component of the cigarette smoke. It can be, you know, applied in mouse to develop squamous cell lung cancer. It takes about 24 weeks or 6 months. Same way one can inject NNK, again, another smoke constituents at a certain dose intraperitoneally in the mouse, and by 20 weeks, you can start getting development of adenocarcinoma type of lung cancer. So again, the utility of these chemically induced models is you can combine it with different things. For example, if you were to alter the genetic background of a mouse, for example, delete or duplicate a gene, will they develop the cancer more frequently or develop it less frequently? So thereby establishing a correlation or maybe a casual connection, a causal connection between a certain gene or pathway and lung cancer. For transgenic mouse models, again, just like with any other type of cancer in their animal models, for lung cancer also people have developed inducible models, for example, by you can use tetracycline to induce a certain oncogene in the mouse model. There are knock-in alleles, the conditional knockout or knock-in kind of systems and so forth. So this is just a partial list from this paper, which was published in 2009, 6-7 years ago. And you can see all the different types of models which have been used in mouse to develop or generate certain type of cancer or pre-malignant lung cancer lesion for biological studies. For cell lines, again, lung cancer, there are literally hundreds of cell lines. common commercial vendors like ATCC, you can find, I think they have at least 80 or so cell lines that you can get. And they represent all types of lung cancer, human adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, carcinoids, etc. And but it's interesting that for mouse, there are only two or three lung cancer cell lines. The very well-known one is something called the Lewis lung carcinoma cell line. So the drawback with the human cell lines, if you want to do mouse experiments, you cannot use the human cell line in a mouse experiment unless the mouse is immunodeficient. The reason being that the human cell line will be immunologically rejected. So to work with immunocompetent mice, the only way or one of the simpler ways is to use the use a mouse cell line, and that's where you get restricted. You have only one or two types or three mouse cell lines. So this is something to be aware of. But people do use a patient tumor sample. So once the patient lung cancer has been resected out, a piece of it can be xenografted in mouse, again immunodeficient mouse, and then you know particular aspects of the tumor can be studied. For example, does it respond to certain combination of drugs and so forth. So etrasil also, when people are doing that kind of research. With the cell lines, again, the cell lines, like I said, they can be xenografted, injected subcutaneously, for example, in immunocompetent mouse, the human cell line, and then you can study different things. For example, if you were to engineer a certain gene in a cell line, does it become more cancerous or does it become more benign and so forth. And many of these cell lines have been very well characterized, so you can find a lung cancer cell line which is mutated in a certain gene. So if you're interested in studying or examining some aspect of a particular gene or combination of genes, you can choose that cell line which suits your research question. In terms of therapy, like I mentioned, surgery is the primary therapy, so everything else is add-on, like for a second-line therapy where surgery failed or surgery is not possible, or in clinical trials where you want to combine with surgery something else to make to reduce recurrence rate or to improve overall survival in the patient. So one of the aspects of therapy for lung cancer is immunotherapy, which actually has been tried since the 80s and 90s. But again, with new ways of doing immunotherapy, there's been a resurgence in lung cancer immunotherapy research. And so it's right now a hot area of research, and many people in Roswell are getting into it. And it is interesting because it combines many different things. There's cancer biology, there is immunology, and a way to look at how we can make things better. Some of the knowledge which is gained from other cancers apply to lung cancer and vice versa. So the findings which are obtained with lung cancer research are applicable to other types of research. I think you had a lecture on immunotherapy, right? In general, so I'm not going to talk too much about it, but for lung cancer, these four or five different approaches, immunotherapeutic approaches, have been tried. So obviously, the simplest thing which comes to mind is if something is altered in lung cancer, something is promoting lung cancer and it's a protein which is accessible, why don't you throw in an antibody and that will block the protein and prevent the lung cancer from being cancerous. Then there is the immune checkpoint blockade, where you alter genes so that the immune system is more active. Then other ways are, maybe you can, instead of throwing an antibody, maybe you can combine the antibody with a toxin, like a cholera toxin or something, which will target a cancer cell. So any cancer cell which is presenting an antigen which is not seen in normal cells will bind the antibody along with the toxin, and that will kill that cell. So other approaches, there are vaccines, and then there is something called the adoptive cell therapeutic approaches. I will briefly cover some of these. So in general, again, this is like a quick slide, and it's actually not completely true, but in general, you have tumor cells or the cancerous cells in the tumor, and then the tumor is infiltrated, the microenvironment of the tumor cells has these tumor-infiltrating immune cells. They include T cells, they include antigen-presenting cells, and the tumor cells themselves can also present antigens. So antigen presentation is required for the tumor cell to be recognized by these other immune cells for some action to happen. So the tumors can escape immune surveillance or immune reaction if for some reason they do not present antigens. That antigen presentation on the tumor cells or through antigen presenting cells is reduced, or for example, these immune checkpoints are active and they're preventing immune stimulation. So some of these anti-PD-1, CTLA-4, these kind of approaches which are being tried, they rely on removing the immune checkpoint. So if you can have antigens present and the checkpoint is gone, then the immune system is active and it can maybe take care of the cancer. With monoclonal antibodies, again, people have known for quite a while things like proteins which promote, for example, angiogenesis. If you were like VEGF, if you were to block VEGF from working, can you then kill the tumor in some way? So monoclonal antibodies of a variety of types have been tried. Some of these trials are still going on by themselves, by combination or in combination with other things. These are just some examples. So obviously EGFR is a major player. So if you can block EGFR, will it prevent lung cancer progression, for example? Same way, the MET oncogene is again a major player. You have antibodies against the MET protein. Then obviously the VEGF protein that I talked about. In general, the results from these trials are not very good. So you can find a subset of patients, maybe a late-stage tumor, and you can increase the survival by maybe 2 months or 3 months. But if you look at the overall picture, it's not good. Nothing has been, dramatic. So most of the survival values are very incremental, and obviously these are very expensive treatments. So people are continuing trying to get some better handle on this. Maybe combining these antibodies with something else will make the overall picture look better, and so forth. Then these are some other immunotherapeutic approaches which have been tried. So for example, this antigen, MUC1, is expressed on cancer cells, lung cancer cells, and some other types of cancer cells. And the expression is higher in lung cancer cells compared to normal lung cells. So the idea here is that if you were to somehow deliver a piece of this MUC1 protein, maybe the immune cells will be primed to detect MUC1, and once the cancer progresses or starts appearing, they will be able to attack these MUC1 positive cancer cells. Another approach which has been tried is basically this group, they took 4 different human lung cancer cell lines, irradiated them so that they can't grow on their own. And then, and these cell lines had an antisense gene against TGF-beta, one of the TGF-beta molecules. So TGF-beta, again, like I showed you in a previous slide, is one of the pathways involved in lung cancer. So if you can block that pathway, maybe it will reduce lung cancer. So there have been a number of trials using this method where they took these cell lines and used that as a vaccine. Then again, MAGE-A3 is another epitope which is present or expressed more in lung cancer cells. And people have tried this as a vaccine therapy. And a lot of these have, like I said, have not yielded positive results or significantly good results. But one vaccine which you may have heard of because of how Roswell is involved is this lung cancer vaccine from Cuba. So Cuba has developed the world's first so-called lung cancer vaccine, and it is to be used as a therapeutic vaccine, but people believe that it has the potential to be a preventive vaccine also. So the same strategy, maybe with some modification, can be used to have a vaccine which can be injected into, let's say, chronic smokers who cannot quit, in the hope that it will reduce their chance of developing cancer. So it took a while, 2-3 decades to develop at the Center for Molecular Immunology. It goes by the name CIMAVAX, EGF. It is not approved in the US by FDA or in other countries, but there are agreements in place to bring it into trial in the United States, in Japan, European country, etc. So in the United States, it's the Roswell Park, which is partnering to get into this. And in fact, I think this year's Ride for Roswell event is about this vaccine, to get money to do more research with this vaccine. So what is this vaccine? This is basically a very simple concept. So if lung cancer has EGFR or EGF receptors, which bind to EGF, which is a growth promoter, then what if you were to block EGF from binding by using an antibody against the EGF? So EGF is in circulation. You have an antibody which prevents the EGF from binding and promoting growth of lung cancer cells. So obviously vaccines are not that simple. They have to combine the antibody against EGF. they have to combine. So the strategy to generate the anti-EGF antibodies is to use EGF to immunize. So basically, you're immunizing with EGF, and this vaccine has other components to make sure that the immune reaction, the response, is very strong. And they have shown in many papers. This is a paper from 2008. In this study, stage 3B or 4, basically late stage lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer patients, were either vaccinated or were not given any vaccine. And then over time, their EGF levels, the serum EGF levels, and how much EGF antibodies they have was measured. So this vaccine was deemed successful in the study. Over time, EGF levels went down. The anti-EGF antibody levels went up because of the vaccination with the EGF antigen. So this was a phase two trial. In phase three trials, this has been taken further. And so right now the consensus is that people who have high levels of EGF, they will respond well to this vaccine. People who have low levels of EGF may not respond to this vaccine. So in this study, which just came out a couple of months ago, again, stage 3B or 4 non-small cell lung cancer patients were treated or vaccinated with the EGF antigen, or with a control group where they were not given this vaccine. The ones who received the vaccine, they had better survival. And those who were not given the vaccine had reduced survival. So right now, this is one of the most promising things in immunotherapy for lung cancer. And so that's why it's being taken further. And hopefully, this will be something good. Then there are other approaches to vaccine. For example, you may have heard of vaccines, basically, which will generate some response to presence of nicotine. So if you can just prevent people from getting high by the nicotine, maybe you can stop them from smoking, and that will help. Finally, adoptive cell therapy. Basically, you remove cells from the patient, immune cells from the blood of the patient, and then you engineer them by introducing genes or treating them with certain cytokines. So they acquire a phenotype which is useful to fight against the cancer. So you can, for example, generate natural killer cell populations from using blood from the patients, and then inject them. Once you grow them in substantial number, you can inject them back into other patients, and maybe they will fight very effectively. But again, these have not worked out very well. One of the things which has some promise is something called the CAR therapy, or basically you remove T cells from the patient's blood and you engineer them genetically. So now they have a T cell receptor which can recognize cancer antigens. And then this T cell receptor, expressing T cells, are injected back in the patient. And this approach has been tried for a number of cancers, including lung cancer. And so this has some promise. So now we switch to targeted therapies for lung cancer. So basically, as I mentioned, surgery remains the primary mode of therapy. In terms of medical therapy, the current workflow is something like this. You have non-squamous or adenocarcinoma type of lung cancer, and you have squamous. And so the basic thing is in adenocarcinoma, you want to look for mutations in the EGFR gene or rearrangements in another gene, the ALK gene. So depending on the results that you get, you can fine-tune your therapy. So the first-line therapy, for example, if the patient is EGFR mutation positive, is to treat it with an inhibitor of the EGFR pathway. And if they are not positive, then you kind of stick to standard chemotherapy, like platinum-based chemotherapy. So currently, you have for the different types of mutations that occur in lung cancer, you do have targeted therapies for EGFR. Obviously, we have these tyrosine kinase inhibitors, erlotinib, gefitinib, and so forth, for ALK gene rearrangements, which occur more in squamous cell type of cancer. You have crizotinib, and then you have some other reagents. So erlotinib is a classical example of targeted therapy. EGFR and EGF association with lung cancer has been known for a long time. In the 1990s, people discovered a particular group of compounds which can inhibit the tyrosine kinase activity of EGFR proteins. And based on those, erlotinib was developed. It was approved about 10 years ago. And then it is currently in use. A variety or a variant of erlotinib, gefitinib, was approved later, so it is able to target certain kind of EGFRs, even though they have mutations which will inactivate the activity of erlotinib. For the ALK gene rearrangements which occur in squamous cell carcinoma, there is crizotinib, which was developed about 10 years ago, and people used it and found that squamous cell carcinoma responds well to crizotinib, and it has been approved. So for example, etrasil, use of erlotinib and crizotinib, mainly again for late stage lung cancer, is now standard practice, and insurance companies largely support the use of these drugs. We're coming towards the end. So one of the things that people have wondered about is, besides preventive vaccines, can you have some other approaches to reduce lung cancer from occurring? So obviously, you know about vitamin D, for example, or certain nutritional supplements like selenium or antioxidants, which have been shown to play a role in, you know, protecting against certain cancers. So people have looked at how the repurposing of known medications or supplements, how can that be helped? How can that be used to help reduce the burden of lung cancer? So many of these studies are really epidemiological studies. Very few are, you know, randomized kind of case control kind of studies or prospective studies. So, but people have examined a wide variety of classes of drugs. And one of the things which has appeared promising is a drug which is called metformin. And people have, again, using epidemiological data and cancer registry data, they found that metformin can reduce recurrence of cancer following treatment, the mortality associated with cancer, and in some cases, even the incidence of cancer itself. So metformin is, you probably know, is an anti-diabetic drug. It's a very simple compound for this group of chemicals which go by the name biquinide. And it has been known for actually many centuries, and it occurs naturally in certain plants, and people have used this as a treatment for metformin. It was chemically made almost a century ago, and its efficacy was noted in the 50s and 60s. It got approved in European and Asian countries before it got approved in the US, but right now it's the most widely used anti-diabetic in the country. So what people have done is, you have, you know, these registry, cancer registries, you have data on thousands, tens of thousands of cancer patients. Usually most of them are old, many, you know, 20-25% of them are diabetics. So you can look at what's the correlation between use of certain drugs. So they noted that use of metformin was associated with reduced burden of the lung cancer, meaning reduced recurrence rate, reduced mortality, and so forth. So people still don't understand how exactly it happens. So is it that metformin is reducing blood glucose and that's how it's affecting the cancer? Or is it some other pathway? For example, maybe it is through insulin that this is happening. Or is it, so the exact mechanistic way in which metformin is helping treat cancer is not known. But there are a lot of studies now. One of this is a study from Roswell, for example, where they found that at Roswell, over the last 5 years or so, there were, I think, 800 or so non-small cell lung cancer cases who were treated by surgery, stage one cases. And those who took metformin survived longer, or meaning the recurrence rate was much less, and the overall survival was much better compared to those who did not take metformin. So there is strong preliminary data to justify why this needs to be studied. Same thing has been seen with other cancers, as I mentioned. This is an example for ovarian cancer. Again, those who were taking metformin compared to diabetics who were not taking metformin. In all these studies, it's diabetics, or the entire population is diabetics with cancer. So they're comparing those who took metformin versus diabetic who did not take metformin. So metformin, again, it has the molecular effects appear to be of wide variety, and some of the pathways have been examined and believe that this AMP kinase pathway mediates some of the action. Some of the metformin actions are not mediated through AMP kinase, but through direct action on the mitochondria, the mitochondrial respiratory complexes. So it's not known which of these signaling pathways are affected in the metformin's role on cancer. So that was the last slide. And I can take more questions from you. As I said, I have skipped over many aspects of lung cancer research. Biomarker research is a big aspect of research. If you can develop, so right now, there's no easy way to diagnose lung cancer. Most of the lung cancer identifications occur by accident. People go to a doctor for the annual visit, an X-ray is taken, and the nodule is seen, and that's how this is the cancer. But otherwise, there is no simple way. On the other hand, there's a huge population of people who are susceptible to lung cancer, chronic smokers, especially who are getting old. So is there a way to diagnose or lung cancer? And this is very important, because if you can pick up lung cancer early, you can, the cure rate is quite high. But if it goes beyond stage 1B, 2A, it's not good. So early diagnosis is very important, and that's where if you can identify biomarkers of any type, it could be DNA, it could be circulating microRNAs, it could be urinary microRNAs, so forth. But there's really, again, nothing good, meaning there's no well-established way to do so. So, but people still keep trying and with different approaches, and maybe there will be something someday. But right now, nothing really. So the only currently approved way for screening chronic smokers is through use of CT. So there was a big trial where people looked at if you were to follow chronic smokers using CT versus not following them, and then see the eventual outcome in terms of mortality, occurrence of lung cancer, etc. They found that there was a significant reduction or better identification of lung cancer if with the CT-based screening method. So, and the cost was deemed, not too expensive with regard, in terms of benefit, the overall benefit to the society in having less expenditure to take care of lung cancer and so forth. So screening right now, only the CT-based method is available. There's nothing simple. So biomarker research, again, there are other aspects of biomarker research also. For example, can you predict if the cancer will recur after the surgery, so you can treat them more aggressively, maybe take out a bigger portion of the lung, maybe simultaneously give them some other type of therapy. That's again a very important area of research which people are have been and are still pursuing. So no questions? Okay. Thank you.